This is the Big Web Show. It's a big episode number 440. Same number of episodes as Jeffrey Zeldman is years young. This is the Big Web Show. It features special guests like an amazing guest that we have today. And we talk about web publishing, art direction, content strategy. It's everything web that matters. Our sponsors today are MailChimp.com and CodeConf.com, but we'll talk about them more later. Let's introduce the people who make this show happen. And the first one of those is Jeffrey Zeldman. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Doing great. How's New York?
New York is bitter cold today.
Is it really?
Icy. Icy cold. Yeah.
Glad I'm not there.
But sunny and lovely.
Well, who's our guest?
Our guest is the amazing Mr. Andy Rutledge. He is the co-founder of a design agency called Unit Interactive, which I advise our readers to check out. It's very nice work. He's a blogger, designer, composer, which I want to hear more about. I have that in my background too, but I didn't know that about Andy. Author, speaker, bonsai artist, which I know a little about, and we're probably not going to talk about that, but who knows. Okay. Capitalist, which is a big part of his message. And for me, the thing that I noticed the most about Andy is that he's one of the very few voices that I know that's constantly talking about the design profession and respect for the profession and what a profession means. Profession versus, say, you're writing now about profession versus what? Vocation?
Sure, or even just commercial design.
Right. One of the things that you've talked about that appeals to me a lot is designers, not being ashamed or not apologizing for making a buck as part of what they do.
Right.
Because I know that my dad was poor and had to work hard his whole life and only stopped recently and not by choice. But my mom wasn't rich either, but we had mixed messages. In my family, it was sort of, there was a sense that the poor, that there was a lot of injustice in the world. From my mom, I got a lot of that. And so I always sort of apologized as I became successful. And I know that in our profession, there's a whole lot of, Think of this. I'm going to start with this, and then I'm going to ask you to respond. Sorry for rambling a little bit. Imagine any other profession. Imagine if plumbers had to have an organization like AIGA and a website like NoSpec convincing them around the clock not to work for free. Imagine plumbers having to be told that they shouldn't go fix people's toilets for free.
Right.
Your response, sir.
Yeah, no, that's it would indeed be a terrible world. This is something that it's just kind of, I think it's a little crazy to look back on our profession over the past few years, and we can do this very easily with the web now. I mean, we have a pretty good insight into what we've been doing, and the things that we do just don't fit how we would choose to represent ourselves. And we tend to, in too many cases, I think, get used by people who have their own ideas how they should utilize us and their own ideas about what our profession is, how it fits into the scheme of things. And most of the time, that's wrong.
What do you say to someone who says, I have to take whatever client I can get? I've got $8,000 a month studio rent to pay. I've got a payroll. And whoever walks in that door, whatever, of course I want to do great work. Of course I want portfolio pieces. I want to do work that succeeds for my client. But I need X billings just to make it to the end of the month. So I'm going to take whoever I get. Isn't that a compelling argument? I need billings.
Well, it is. But they're right. They have to take what they can get. All of us, in some measure, have to take what we can get. However, what we can get is made by the standards that we maintain and represent generally from the beginning. I mean, you start off making do and taking what you can get and equating getting a project and getting a really big client or something with success, then you're going to do what it takes to take what you can get there. However, if you begin by learning, spending some time in a good agency, or actually any agency, you can see what's good and bad about that, and develop your own ideas from some your own ideas of professionalism based on what you've observed and absorbed, and from your own kind of core values, and you represent yourself as a professional, and you have professional standards. Then, based on those standards, you will get different things than you would get if you didn't have those standards. And so you, sure, you always take what you can get, but you'll be getting things that maintain your professionalism if you yourself maintain your professionalism.
I was in advertising before I became a designer, and I remember seeing a headhunter who told me I was never going to get a good advertising job because the first agency I worked for was bad. First agency I worked for wasn't good, and I shouldn't have been there. Therefore, I was only, you know, I could make a living, but I would never be at a good place. Mm-hmm. How do you succeed? How do you, if you have a sense of design ethics, but you don't work for yourself, what do you do if you're the only person at your company, if you're the only person at your agency that has a strong sense of design ethics and what you will and won't do on behalf of a client, but your boss is telling you, you know, that's really nice. Go make a speech at AIGA, but what I need you to do is blah, blah, blah. What do you do?
All right. Well, you can do a couple of things. You can change things. And even if you're kind of a junior person, you have to be the kind of person who can affect change. This is part of what being a design professional is about, so you can start there. If you're not able to do that, then you have to consider a couple of things. Are you any good as a designer? Are you any good at what you do? And if you are, and you have some kind of reputation to back that up among initially your peers, your friends, and then the smaller and then wider community, and then ultimately, you know, the world at large, then you've got something to build on. And you're going to get, you know, a better position somewhere else. So make the change where you are, or go somewhere where it's not terrible. Go somewhere where you can behave and perform the way that you think you should.
What do you think about doing portfolio pieces, unpaid portfolio pieces, to get a better job? Not on behalf of a client, but simply, you know, creating something for the community for free, putting it out there for free to get, you know, to get known. Like my friend and studio mate, Tim Murtaugh, not to get known, but just because this is the kind of guy he is, he made a HTML5 reset. And that's a very cool resource that a lot of people have used. What about designers? Okay, so what about designers enhancing their reputation, regardless of, you know, how or where they're employed, by making free things and giving them to the community? Mm-hmm. Do you have an issue with that, or do you think that's a cool thing to do?
No, I think it's absolutely a cool thing to do, because these things are, if they become successful, it's because they're inherently useful. And for instance, if you wanted to make something like that, it's because it's solving a problem that you have, or it's addressing a need that you have, or you think it's super cool, and you make it and you want to share that. That is wonderful. I mean, that's part of what I think, you know, all of us should be doing, and most of us are, I think. There are countless examples of that. That I don't see that as any kind of compromise or any kind of anti-capitalist, you know, anti-professionalism kind of a thing. It's just, it is more and more. It's what we do.
Where do you, you have a very strongly developed sense of, and I know you're going to be writing about it, where do you, or you are writing about it, it's just not, you know, you've been writing about it on your blog, and I know you're working on a book. Where does it come from? What resources do you is this something you kind of created for yourself out of whole cloth, or was there one article at AIGA or somewhere that you said that's it, that's the right? I mean, where did it come from? Is it all you?
No, it's certainly not all me. I came up my being you know, having a gray beard here. I've been doing some things for a while, and I spent a lot of years in retail. And while in large part retail isn't necessarily a profession, there are professional practices that you adopt, or you get fired, or your enterprise is very successful. And so that, plus being observant and looking at what other professions how they comport themselves, what their standards are, how they interact with clients as opposed to customers, for instance. All of these things are the things that the design profession, when I got into the design profession, it's what I expected and saw very little evidence of it. And even maybe kind of more dismaying, I saw more evidence of the things that were kind of anti-professional being championed by folks. Look how cool this is. You know, I'm giving away, I'm apologizing for what I'm doing. And in fact, I'm going to give it away for free for as long as I can. All I guess, I mean, it's this contrast with what you brought up earlier about just making things because you think they're cool and releasing them.
Because those are also free. Yeah, so help us understand right. The thinking. And I'm not challenging you. I want to understand the distinction.
No, challenge me.
Okay. I want to bring out the difference.
Okay. Well, it has to do also with what else are you doing? Okay. So you're doing whatever free thing that you're doing, whatever thing to help your community or to solve someone's problem, and you know you don't have a problem giving that away for free. What else are you doing? How are you conducting your business? How you work at the agency where you work? How are you at the agency that you run? How are you talking to your clients? How do you represent your brand, whether it's your personal brand or your company's brand? These are the things that are so often lacking. It's not the fact that there's also, you know, altruistic motivations among many of us.
What is the overlap between the Unit Interactive brand and the Andy Rutledge brand? Because when I go to the website of Unit Interactive, I can see, you know, very professional work. I mean, but to me, in a way, your brand almost eclipses it, and just because you're a person, right? And it's easier to deal with people than agencies. It's easier to understand people than agencies. How do you ever say to yourself, I really want to write this very strong blog piece, but gosh, it might impact my business negatively, or my partner might not like it, so I won't do it. Do you show everything to your partners and get their approval? Are you all like-minded? How does that work?
Well, sometimes. I guess to kind of start at the beginning, sort of separating my personal brand with my agency's brand. Mm-hmm. There's obvious overlap, and I'm sure you and anyone else can perceive that. And in my mind, that is what an agency's brand should spring from. There are individuals working there. It's however many. It's two or it's, you know, 200. These are individuals working there, and of course, this is easier to maintain and develop when you've got, you know, a handful of people. But these are the folks that are going to be working on your project if you work with us. And so, and I'm kind of the loudest, most conspicuous voice in there. But you know, everyone else at Unit has things to say, and they do so on their own sites and on our blog and stuff. But that's how you build, aside from the quality of the work that your agency puts out, that's how you build, you know, the agency's reputation. It's based on the individuals. And so the individuals, they should not shy away, I think. This is my perspective. They shouldn't shy away from speaking loudly when they have something of conviction to say. But that also means something to who is employed at that agency. Who am I as a co-owner? Who are Angela and I hiring? Well, we can't make the mistake of just hiring someone who has awesome skills. These have to be people who are moral, ethical, good stand-up people, people who already kind of understand what professional values, even though they maybe are just starting out. And so you're allowed to do that.
Do you have discussions with them about this? Do you have a little handbook for your company that says, like, you know, here are the 12 things that we believe that we need to know that you believe if you're going to work with us? Or how does that work? Because that adds another layer of complexity to the hiring process. It's already hard enough finding the right people, and I mean, I agree with you. The people are everything, but how do you go about that?
Well, number one, it's tough. We do have a we don't have a handbook. We have like about a 2-page printout of sort of our brand values. It's something that I wrote up with Angela. Kind of, I got the idea to we should probably codify these things for ourselves, not necessarily put out there. And we did that, and I think I probably published it as a blog post or something too. But knowing for ourselves precisely what we were after and what our brand, the company's brand represents, was an important thing for us to establish, even though we kind of understood these things amongst ourselves anyway, but then applying that to the hiring process, we just have to know. I mean, this isn't something we share with someone until after we hire them. The hiring process, the interview process is, you know, you cull greatly based on, you know, these things that we already sort of hold as important. And it does impact the, you know, the hiring process a bit.
How do you allocate time for your employees to write? I mean, if you come in and you say, where's the such and such project? And someone says, you know, I'll have that for you, but right now I'm blogging. Is that an okay answer? And also, in your opinion, if a company is made up of individuals who need to put their stamp on things, how much should everyone who's listening to this, who's in our business, be writing? Should everyone who's, and how much time should they put into that? Or are there people who can have great careers but aren't particularly writers?
Wow. Well, again, to start with the first part of that, okay, everyone here has time to do pretty much anything they think is important. And it's kind of here at our agency, there's no time clock. There's no, you know, I need you to be working on X. Everyone who works here, the way that we divvy up projects is there's always a primary designer on a project, that the one person who knows it's their responsibility to bring things home. Right now, everyone may work together, or a few of us may work together, but one person knows the onus is on them. Therefore, they know what the deadline is for the next deliverable. They know what the overall scope is, so they know what work they need to do. How they accomplish that is none of my concern, really. And part of that is because Angela and I have hired good people. And I think other agencies, I don't want to make this all about Unit, but any agency that hires great people can allow them whatever latitude is appropriate based on their sort of company company processes. And so things get accomplished how they need to, according to the person who has ultimate responsibility. And as far as allowing them time to write, certainly I think a lot of personal things and voice things for individuals here happen here at work, and I think that's just fine. Because it is part of how we, anyway, and I think a lot of web agencies will help build their brand and build the personal brands of the people who are involved in that. In other professions, writing is, I'm sure many of them, for many of them, writing is going to be a good way for this to happen, but I don't think it has to happen. There are other ways. So a lot of professions have other more social things where you're pressing flesh and you're meeting people and you're making connections, and that is the primary way of getting the word out, or even advertising. And then when potential clients touch base with you, then you get to further express your brand and give them insight into what you're doing. We do it the way that feels right to us.
Now, Andy, I've got a couple questions coming in from the chat room. We like to do that to encourage people. You can go to 5by5.tv/live and there's a chat room. So I'll relay some of those questions. Before we do that, we have to thank our sponsor. It's CodeConf 2001. You can go to codeconf.com to learn more, but here's what they say. Coding is about more than just code, whether it's building a solid community, writing good documentation, or hacking space exploration. CodeConf is about improving the software ecosystem through best practices. You can go there with an open mind and you will leave a better programmer. There are only 300 seats available, so you can register today at codeconf.com. Go check it out. It's in San Francisco. It is it's at the Hyatt Regency out there. It's a beautiful time of year to go, so go check that out. Now, let me ask you one of these questions that came in. Do the ethics, dimension, values that you were talking about, do those apply? This is from Tim H. in the chat room. Do these apply to the clients you work for? And he says, for example, would you work or do work for an arms company, for example?
Well, I don't know that I want to get into specifics of who we here would and would not work with, but just to sort of answer the hypothetical, the values of the values, especially as expressed in our interactions, are extremely important in who we work with. I think I don't keep formal records on this, but I expect we turn down probably 60-70% of the projects that are that people contact us about, just because it's not right for us in some way. And sometimes it has to do with the people involved. We have a kind of a tense, harried discussion on the phone, or their manner isn't right, or what they say they're trying to do with this project just kind of rubs us the wrong way. And so absolutely, that is very important, because this is someone you're going to be spending likely months with.
How do you know that then? How do you know that potential client that's hiring you, in a way you're hiring them, you hear that a lot. Mm-hmm. How do you know that? I mean, what are there signs to look for? And I'm not talking about for designers or developers who are just early starting out, who need to make a buck and they'll take whatever project that comes their way. I'm talking about mm-hmm. once you're over that initial hump and you can start making decisions. How do you do that? What are the clues to look for?
Well, first of all, you have to know how to ferret out this information, and there is no other way than to spend time talking to them, first of all. Now, obviously, you're going to touch base with them on the specifics of the project because you need to know the scope and these kinds of things.
Right.
But you need to talk about with them for as long as is, you know, appropriate, as long as you can get away with, in many cases, how bring up topics that beg, you know, that sort of ferret out this information. Spend time talking to them before you ever actually kind of get down to the specifics of the project. Talk about how their company works. Talk about how they expect to engage, you know, with you. And so you have to, the main thing that I think so many people miss is just spending that time. And I'm talking about direct conversation, either face-to-face or on the phone. Emails don't do it. RFPs don't do it. In fact, RFPs don't work in the design profession. You have to know who you're working for, and so you've got to spend the time to find that stuff out. And like I told you, I come from a retail background, and so you learn probing questions. You learn the kind of questions that elicit information, and these are things that I use to in my design work.
What was your retail background? You mentioned it, retail, and I mean, you don't have to get specific, but was it what were you doing there? General manager.
I was the general manager for a small chain of Hallmark stores, Hallmark card and gift stores.
Oh wow,
yeah, that was me, and that was about 12 years, and we started with 2 stores and then built up to 4 stores, and I was not every day, but for the most case. In all 4 stores, or at least a couple of them every day.
How and why did you get out of that industry?
It was taken away from me. The owners had basically had enough of doing retail and closed all of the stores.
Oh wow! That will put you out of a job if you're.
Yeah, it will.
So
did you go right to starting your own company from that? I think that's where you're.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
Wow. That. Yeah, that started a 2-year period of what some people call unemployment, and what I called research and school and knocking around, so I did a lot of things. Almost all of it involved in building skills, developing skills that ultimately led to where I am. You know what I'm doing now, but ultimately the first thing that happened almost 2 years after that was I got hired on at a design development agency. So that was my first design, professional design job.
So, I mean, what did you feel like that was, I mean, was this a conscious decision that you made? Like, this is what my passion is. This is what I want to do. Or was it more like, oh, this looks like a neat job. I'll try this out. And it became something bigger.
No, I mean, but even while I was working, in retail, I was trying to build websites. I was working with, I think, Frontpage beginning, and then got Dreamweaver. And I was always trying to do things for friends and family. And because, I mean, I'm a lifelong artist, musician, whatever. That's what I've done since I was able to walk. And so this, I discovered that this was kind of a neat expression of that. It was a different medium, but it was the same thing. And in fact, I mean, I kind of hold that all of the artistic endeavors, whether it's painting or acting or poetry or dance or web design or whatever, they're exactly the same thing. They play by the exact same rules. They succeed and fail according to the same criteria. And so I was very comfortable doing this. I just lacked a lot of skill. And so I spent a lot of time online reading people's blogs and learning how to do this stuff.
It's interesting, though, to me that you came from the world that sort of the other side. You mentioned, Dreamweaver and apps like that. That these days, I think people don't really remember as much, but I know Jeffrey and I can talk about those when those were known as, oh no, they did the site in one of those apps, you know, that generate tons and tons and tons of unmanageable, unreadable code. And, you know, meanwhile, you've got Jeffrey over there doing, you know, page spinner and writing things by hand. And, you know, the rest of us just using plain old text editors. And it seems like those people are the ones who are the most familiar, or at the time were the ones who really embraced this web standards movement. Mm-hmm. And to see you coming from a different direction, what was your take on that? I mean, obviously it's important to you, but maybe you can talk about how your entry point for that.
There was a certain amount of buzz online in whatever blogs and forums, you know, you'd visit then about web standards and why that was important. And of course, there was a quite extended period of, you know, the whole smarmy, you know, if you're not using, you know, if you're using tables, you're just a terrible, horrible person. You know? You're ugly and people have told me so. But the first thing that did it for me was, you know, reading Jeff's book, Jeffrey's Designing with Web Standards. And that was the thing that made it seem like I could do this, I think. You know, this is kind of the way to do it. I know, I feel the pressure. And I can remember I was working at that first agency, and I remember sitting in a discovery, and I told the client at the end of it, okay, well, I'm going to build the site out according to web standards, no tables, it'll be something that you'll be able to use for a long time. And then I was like, holy cow, how am I going to do that? And so I had to, I told the client I was going to do it, so I had to. And so in the span of, you know, whatever, however many weeks it took to do that project, learned how to do it and never went back.
What qualifies you to be, I mean, now obviously you're doing it, but did you feel qualified, and what were your qualifications to actually run a business entity? And this is something that's always fascinating, because as somebody who came from, you know, you mentioned yourself, you're an artist, but then you were in some Hallmark stores running around. I'm sure you had employees, but the dynamic that happens in a design agency, I having done retail myself for a long time, it's so different than that. What qualified you to just step up and say, oh, I'm going to start my own agency and I'm going to hire people and tell them, you know, it, to some degree, direct them and help them figure out what to do with their days?
Well, I mean, a lot of it was, seriously, it was I had, you know, a lot of professional training coming up in working in retail and then running, you know, a small corporation for a little while. And then the couple of three, I guess it was about 3 years I spent at that agency, I had a pretty, I thought, well-rounded idea for how business worked. Number one, I knew how business worked before I got there, but then at the agency, I knew how a design agency could work and where it failed. My partner and I, in fact, used to kind of fantasize, like, wouldn't it be great that we had our own agency that we didn't have to put up with, you know, these things that we're dealing with today. And so we got a very good look at the good and bad in the design industry and how choices came home to roost later when you're running an agency. And so it was just kind of making a leap. I think everyone has to just make the leap. And so we did, and it so far has worked.
Learning from bad experience is great. I'm a big fan of that. I'm also, I've been working for a long time, and most of what I know is because I didn't like an experience or because I felt like, wow, that person didn't give credit. It's really good to give credit. If anyone ever works for me, I'll make sure that they know they're appreciated. Like little obvious stuff like that. But a lot of that too depends on maintaining a personal touch with the people who work for you, the people you work with, the clients you accept. So this kind of raises the question of growth. Inevitably, every company, every agency wants to get bigger. At some point, people turn around and say, well, okay, we're billing $500,000. We could bill $1 million. We're billing $1 million. We could bill $10 million, whatever it is. We got five people. We could have 10. There's a problem with design agencies and creative enterprises generally, where at a certain size, it starts to suck. Because at a certain size, you can't you can't have that one-on-one with your lead designer anymore. You can't be present for all the meetings with all the potential clients to really mm-hmm. sound it out. So when you think about growth for unit, like, do you, is there a number you have in mind, or do you just, is it an organic thing? How big can you get? How big do you want to get?
I think right off the bat, Angela and I both had the idea that we were never going to get bigger than 7 people, including ourselves. Wow. And I don't know where that number came from. And I don't know what that number is where the company gets, you know, too big that it's just, it's not what you wanted and it doesn't work the way that you wanted it to work. But I do know that 7 feels right as the biggest we want to get. Right now we're 5. So we're kind of closing in on that and can already kind of feel some of the pressures that are new as opposed to having 3 people. And so I think it's important. I don't think it's important for everyone. It's important for us because one of the kind of the primary tenets of our business is quality of life. We want to have quality of life, and we're willing to trade dollars in for the ability to have our schedules be extremely flexible and to work the way we want to work and to turn down the business we want to turn down. And that's actually, that's another component of this whole sort of uncompromising professionalism is that it's going to cost you and you have to be prepared for the cost.
Right.
But we're willing to trade that.
Talk a little more about that if you would.
Well, I told you before that it's probably somewhere between 60 and 70% of the projects that are, that come to us, someone has interest in working with us that we ultimately either turn down or don't end up working on. And well, most of that is turned down.
Do you have a nice way of doing that? I mean, it's kind of like a dating problem in a way. Like, you're nice, but I'm not attracted to you, right? So how do you gracefully handle that situation so that the person doesn't feel disrespected or rejected, or do you not worry about that?
Well, no, I do worry about that. I mean, you don't go around burning bridges, you know, being a badass, you know, showing how strong you are by, you know, telling people off or whatever. It's just, it depends on the situation. The circumstances may allow for you to say, well, this particular thing that you're looking for or way that you want to do it or whatever is not something that we're prepared to do. You don't have to be more specific than that. It's just, we're not prepared to do that. Or this is not something, we're not a best fit for you. Someone else may. And oftentimes I'll refer people to other agencies or even freelancers because I know that that kind of a thing is, there's more compatibility there.
So you have a little, to some extent, you have a chain of people that, not of people who will take immoral work, but people who will take work that you're not interested in or who might be a better fit.
Right, yeah. And I don't mean to say that the things that we would turn down on moral grounds or ethical grounds, I want to foist off on someone. I don't refer to those projects. Sure. There is always some component of the project that it is easy to say, this doesn't fit us. We're not the right partner for you on this particular project, or this particular aspect is not something that we can do. Now, I'm not saying we can't do it on moral grounds. I'm just saying we can't do it.
Right.
I tend to be really matter of fact about things. I don't, you know, saying goodbye doesn't have to, you know, take 20 minutes.
Right. And you're good with people because you have that retail background where if you can't do that, you don't survive, right? It's about respect. Yeah, it's about mutual respect.
I definitely recognize that what people skills I have in person, a lot of people on Twitter would say otherwise, but in person, the people skills that I have that I bring to bear when I'm talking to a prospective client definitely comes from retail.
I mean, we all have multiple dimensions to our personality, and there may be, you know, there's the personality that you might have as a writer or as an advocate of a particular way of looking at things, and then there's the personality that you have as someone to work with, you know, the personality you have as a friend. It's all quite different. And mm-hmm. you know, let me ask you about client services versus products, because I think everything that you talk about when you're talking about design professionalism has to do with this notion of you're making something on behalf of a client. Mm-hmm. Do you, with your 5 people, soon possibly to be 7, do you think about product development? Are you not interested in that? Is that, doesn't fit, does it not fit into your vision? Or
No, product development definitely fits into our vision. We our first product was Unify, and that is, by our standards, pretty darn successful in the design community. This is a product that we sell lots every day, and that is a good thing. We're working on this is kind of crazy.
What is it? Unify?
Yes, Unify. But we're working right now on we're working on three projects that are product projects that are our products that will be out either sort of the kind of thing that you just purchase or the kind of thing you subscribe to. So this is something that we have. It's not what we started out wanting to do, but we've discovered that it's something that we really enjoy. And almost all in every respect, it's because we're trying to solve a problem that we have. We want a tool that does X, and so we're going to make it.
How do you, in order to sell Unify and everything else, you have to make a site pretty much for yourself. When you're making stuff to promote your own products, you're your own client. How does that differ? And do you find that actually easier or more challenging as an agency? Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Both. it's easier because you have a very clear idea, I would think, for the most part, what it is you're trying to accomplish and have some really clear idea of what's the best way to do that. But you're so close to it. You're so very close to it. You know, you've got it right up there in front of your eyes, and it's hard to step back to achieve the good things that can come from that kind of some perspective. But I don't know that it's any harder or easier. I think it's got elements of both.
So I've got another couple questions coming in from the chat room here. And before we get to them, we wanted to say also thanks to MailChimp.com. They make it easy to design email newsletters. You can share them on social networks, integrate with web services you already use. You'll love mixing and matching MailChimp's templates. You can think of it as your own personal newsletter publishing platform. And they have a new co-branding feature, so you can add your own logo, colors, background image, and more. Create your own custom experience over there. So check them out. So before we get to these questions from the chat room, you know, one of the things I keep hearing you talk about is that you talk about products. You talk about Unify. I was showing if you're tuning in with the video, people could check that out. There are more and more I see companies that maybe started out in the design space or the development space. They're spinning off actual products and selling those. And you mentioned that by your estimates, by your estimations and your own considerations, I guess, relative to the kind of money that you would make doing design work for people, you say that your products are doing relatively well. When do you make that decision that, you know what, we're not going to do design work anymore, we're just going to focus on our products? Is that something you guys toy with, or is that something you decide ahead that we are or not going to do this?
Yeah, I think everyone here is pretty on board with the idea that that's not going to happen. We do these things because we enjoy it. We think that they're useful tools, so we want to see if others want to play too. We're trying to solve specific problems that we have. But one of the things that we're finding, or we've kind of latched onto, is the idea that if they're successful, these are the kinds of things that will allow us to do what we enjoy. I don't know if it's more, but at least as much, maybe more, and that's working with clients. Because as designers, I'm sure I'm speaking for a lot of designers, just kind of have a compulsion to help solve problems, help people figure out the best way to do whatever it is they're trying to do, to walk them through whatever troubled waters, or to give them handholds to climb whatever mountain they're trying to climb, and then allow them to succeed. Helping other people to succeed is extremely gratifying. I mean, that just jazzes all of us up. And so I think that's always going to be a mainstay of what we're trying to do.
So here's one of the questions that came in. This is from Kazapeta. I guess. Who knows? I'm terrible with names. Can you ask Andy if he has an idea as to why agencies, companies, startups are now setting themselves up smaller and keeping them that way? Because if you remember, even really recently, but definitely a number of years ago, companies were always about getting 1,000 employees as quickly as possible. And you guys are here tentative. Well, maybe we'll add another employee. Why the shift?
I think with very few exceptions, 1,000-person companies suck. there's nothing awesome about a huge mega corporation unless they've done really well. They found ways to do that really well, and so few of them do. You know all the names of the ones that have. But it is it's much easier. It's much easier to stay focused and maintain whatever standards you have. It's easier to make sure everything is happening according to the way that the people whose vision is being articulated here to those kinds of standards. And so small is just really good. It's almost cliche now, but I mean, sort of the boutique design agency was a few years ago was something kind of neat and new, but these were the ones that were kicking butt. And I think, I mean, you can't argue with success and you can't, hide it under a bushel. I mean, people are going to notice and they're going to try and emulate that model. And for good reason.
Yeah.
I think we agree. And I think that's a nice place to wrap for now. You're a very interesting designer, writer, thinker, and I really appreciate your continuing efforts to build respect for our profession. And thank you for coming on the show today.
I appreciate it. It's been a blast. Thanks, guys.
People can follow you at Andy Rutledge on Twitter. They can go to andyrutledge.com to learn about your bonsai stuff.
Okay.
And yeah. I mean, where else are you? Where else should they know about?
Oh, wow. I got a blog, andy-logic.com.
You're
but
on Dribbble.
All this stuff, if you go to
hey, you're Andy on Dribbble Rutledge, too.
Oh, yeah. I'm on Dribbble, Andy Rutledge. But if you go to andyrutledge.com, it has all the links to all that stuff too. Wow. Maybe that's it. Oh, I don't know. I got a bonsai journal as well. BonsaiJournal.com.
Cool. Well, thanks for being
very
here.
Nice.
Thank you very
thanks
much.
Thanks so much.
Next time we'll talk about trees and music.
Awesome. I'm there.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks. Have a good one. Guys. Take care.
Thanks, bye-bye. Everybody, for tuning in. You can hear previous episodes of this show by going to 5x5.tv and check out. There's a whole handful of other shows that we do there. Love for you to check them out. If you enjoyed the show, consider rating it on iTunes. It's the best way to help new listeners find out about the show. And with that said, we will be back at you. I'm not sure if we'll be back next week because a lot of people will be in South by Southwest, but check the schedule. We've got a schedule that we're actually updating now.
We were thinking of doing a best of.
Yeah, I think that's
run during South by. Are we still thinking
about
doing
that?
Yeah,
let's do the best of. We'll do a best of. We'll have the best people, which is really, it's going to be hard to pick because there have been so many awesome people on here.
But I think what we can do is, since there are so many good people, we could just like you could have you asking a brilliant question to Christina Halverson, but then have Jeff Veen's answer. maybe you could work it like that.
I love that idea.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be good, a lot of work for Jim either to
no, easiest thing in the world.
Let's just have him. Yeah. Who cares? He's going to do it. Not me. Right.
He's doing it.
So, but you will be at South by next week.
I'll be at South by looking for fans of 5x5. Or Listapart, or Happy Cog, or web design, or life, or bonsai trees.
Nice. Do you want to pimp this new thing you guys just launched? Do you want to mention that?
Which new thing? Happy Cog hosting?
Yeah. I think you should.
Should I? Okay. Yeah. It's a lovely hosting company for the person who has a very popular site.
For the person who has everything, what do you get them?
For the person who has a very popular site and needs absolutely reliable service and doesn't want to deal with it.
Right.
So if you're like a tinkerer, like we wouldn't be the right client for you because you'd want to go in there and go, oh, I got to update my Ruby on Rails install.
Yeah, I got to monkey around in there.
You've got to monkey around. A server to you is a playroom. And so we're not for you. But thinking of your co-host like Merlin Mann or John Gruber. Somebody has a very popular site, gets a lot of traffic.
Kotke is there, I think.
Kotke is there.
MailChimp is there.
MailChimp is there. Right. Somebody who's totally awesome and has enough technical challenges to deal with and wants to dump that part off to someone else who knows what they're doing. So that's what we do. For only 99 cents a month. It's a pretty good deal.
Actually, it's a little more, but it is worth people checking into. And how's it going? Good launch?
It's good. It's good.
Good.
It's also like we were talking about with Andy. It's really, we want it to be small and focused. And we really don't want every customer in the world. Not that we don't love people. We do. But we really want to provide a certain caliber of service to a small clientele. So sounds like a whorehouse now. So that's,
you know. we should do maybe what we'll do is we'll do a show about this and this kind of thing and how you expand and grow Happy Cog and how it's changed over the years. And just you and I can talk about that. We'll do that in an upcoming show. You'll be the guest. I like it.
Well, if you like it.
I like it. Twitter, if you like the idea, you can tweet Dan Benjamin and Zeldman and let us know if you like the idea. And maybe we'll do that.
And regardless, if you're at South By, we'll see you there. If you're not at South By, that's okay too. Have a great week and love you.
See you next time.